tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting. The leaders of Germany and France are in Moscow, where they are presenting a new peace proposal to the Russian president. The proposal is aimed at ending an escalation of fighting between Ukrainian forces and pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine. German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President François Hollande will meet or are meeting with President Vladimir Putin in the Russian capital. Their meeting comes a day after another meeting in Kiev with Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko. Jens Stoltenberg is the head of NATO, and he spoke today at a security conference in Munich.
In Ukraine, the immediate task is to stop the fighting. Ukraine is a sovereign nation. Its people have the right to live in peace and in security like the rest of us.
Witnesses say the Nigerian militant group Boko Haram attacked a town in Niger today, the Islamist group's second cross-border attack this week. Residents of Basso, a town on Niger's southern border, reported hearing explosions and gunfire as Boko Haram invaded the town. U.S. investigators are trying to determine the cause of a cyber attack on the second largest health insurer in the United States. There are suspicions that China is the source of the hacking. The company, Athenum, disclosed this week that hackers had penetrated its database of some 80 million records of employees and current and former customers. Western media cited sources familiar with the investigation and reported that Chinese hackers may be responsible. This is VOA News. China is opposed to foreign countries receiving the Dalai Lama. That's what a government spokesman reiterated today. That coming a day after Tibetan spiritual leader, the Dalai Lama, attended the annual National Prayer Breakfast in Washington. Demonstrators marched through the streets of Jordan's capital, Amman, today, waving Jordanian flags and chanting slogans against the Islamic State group. The demonstrations followed the murder of a Jordanian military pilot who was burned to death by the Islamist militant group. Lesotho's Minister of Home Affairs and Public Service is quoted by the AFP News Service as saying four Lesotho soldiers have been arrested in South Africa in a plot to kill two of the Prime Minister's bodyguards. The bodyguards were wounded in a shootout in Lesotho's capital, Maseru, on Sunday, and were recovering from their wounds at a South African hospital. The shooters were believed to be angry that the bodyguards foiled an attempted coup last August. Minister Juang Molapo says the four men arrested wanted to finish off the soldiers, who they didn't succeed in killing on Sunday. The AFP reports that North Kivu Province Governor Julian Paluku says suspected rebels from Uganda hacked at least 21 people to death this week in Mayongosa. The town is located in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. The governor says the attackers were mainly Muslim rebels of the Allied Democratic Forces and the National Army for the Liberation of Uganda. The Associated Press reports that Somalia's prime minister has submitted to lawmakers a second proposal for a new cabinet. His first cabinet proposals drew stiff opposition. Prime Minister Omar Abdirashid Ali Sharmarke announced the new 25-member cabinet late Thursday. U.S. President Barack Obama is set to present his plan to deal with foreign policy concerns, ranging from the Islamic State to the rise of China. No major policy changes are expected to be unveiled in the 33-page National Security Strategy document to be presented today to lawmakers. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif are planning to meet in Munich today. They will be discussing negotiations on Iran's nuclear program. Those talks will be held on the sidelines of the ongoing security conference. Turkey's foreign minister pulled out of a security conference in Munich today, saying he did not want to attend a session with an Israeli delegation. Mutlut Çavuşoğlu told reporters in Berlin the decision had nothing to do with Turkey's relationship with Germany. On Wall Street, U.S. stock indexes are up, markets down in Europe. From the VOA News Center in Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to African News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehisu Heben. Coming up this hour on African News Tonight,
Nigeria and its four neighbors have pledged a battalion each to a 7,500-strong force to fight the Nigerian terrorist group Boko Haram. But African Union experts and UN officials have failed to agree on how the joint force will be funded. The issue could delay deployment of the force.
That's Moki Edwin Kinzeka reporting from Yaoundé. Details coming up.
Also, residents of Basso, Niger, say Boko Haram militants from Nigeria attacked their town early today.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Burkina Faso, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, residents of Basso, Niger say Boko Haram militants from Nigeria attacked their town early today. Niger military authorities report that Chadian and Nigerian military aircraft bombed the attackers, who withdrew. A pharmacist in Basso, a town of about 50,000 near the Nigerian border, told the Associated Press by telephone that soldiers battled the rebels for an hour. Abba Hassan said the town's streets are now deserted. There were no reports of casualties. Hassan said military planes from Chad and Nigeria are now conducting aerial surveillance of the region.
Earlier in the week, joint military forces from three neighboring countries reported heavy casualties among Boko Haram rebels after clashes in border communities in Nigeria and Cameroon. Lawmakers in Niger's capital, Niamey, are expected to authorize a fighting force of more than 2,000 to join a regional battle against Boko Haram. Meanwhile, the African Union Commission yesterday approved plans for a regional military force of 7,500 to confront Boko Haram fighters. The AU will request endorsement of the force by the UN Security Council in Geneva next week. Boko Haram has overtaken many communities in three states in northern Nigeria in a five-year campaign to create an Islamist state. More than a million people have been displaced by the violence, and about 10,000 have died.
As we said, Nigeria and its four neighbors have pledged a battalion each of 7,500 strong force to fight the Nigerian terrorist group Boko Haram. But AU experts and UN officials have failed to agree on how the joint force will be funded. The issue could delay deployment of the force. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Cameroon's Minister of Defense, Edgar Aleme Benga, said Boko Haram fighters again challenged African leaders who had called for a regional force to combat the terrorist group by killing at least 100 people in northern Cameroon while the AU meeting was going on. Mbenga said 800 members of the terror group burned churches, mosques and villages and slaughtered youth who resisted joining them. He says 91 civilians were killed, along with at least 13 Chadian and 6 Cameroonian soldiers. Hundreds of people were seriously wounded. Nigeria, Cameroon, Chad, Niger and Benin have agreed to contribute a battalion each to the 7,500-strong force as a matter of urgency. Nigeria's Danjuma Sheni says millions of people have been displaced by the fighting and need the support of the international community. He says besides military support, Nigeria has suggested that the psychological and humanitarian needs of displaced people should be taken care of.
The stakes are, of course, extremely high. Very, very. The issue of refugees, the impact on our economy, the threat to international peace and security. Nigeria is one of the main countries affected by the insurgency, and therefore we expect cooperation from our neighbors and the international community.
Colonel Pele Olio-Alain, Director of Military Operations at the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, told VOA they have been given the mandate to train the multinational task force on what is expected from them before they go to fight Boko Haram.
Amenace global, riposte global.
He says they will give the task force all it needs in terms of concepts of operations, logistic support. He says they will expect funding from external partners. France has, through its ambassador to Cameroon, Christine Robichon, promised to continue assisting the threatened countries, but she says they are waiting for the United Nations Security Council to give the force a legal backing. In an interview with VOA, Robichon condemned the ongoing fighting in northern Cameroon, where the extremists have been on a killing spree.
I want to express the strongest condemnation by France of this horrible violence against civilians and soldiers. We are providing support to increase the capacities of the countries in the region to coordinate their response to the threat. The decision to create such a force has been endorsed by the African Union. The matter will be brought to the Security Council to pass a resolution which will provide legal support and also deal with the financial aspect.
The UN's representative at the AU meeting, Jacqueline Sek-Diouf, told VOA that while the AU wants funding, the UN has promised only logistics. She says the immediate task is to give technical support and that any other assistance will be decided by the Security Council and the Secretary General of the United Nations. She says she has listened to the various suggestions and will submit them to the United Nations. The plan approved in Yaoundé is critical to getting the UN Security Council's blessings for military involvement by the other African nations in the fight against Boko Haram. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
A staggering 2.5 million people in South Sudan are suffering from a high degree of food insecurity, about one-fifth of the total population of the country. The Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, or IPC, reports the new estimates are double the number suffering from severe lack of food a year ago. South Sudan has suffered violent internal conflict in several states for a year now. The IPC report says farmers have missed crop cycles in those states due to the fighting.
Well, today is International Day of Zero Tolerance to Female Genital Mutilation. The World Health Organization is joining others in demanding an end to the procedure still widely practiced in the developing world. Female genital mutilation, or FGM, is a procedure that can cause severe physical problems such as complications in childbirth, maternal deaths, heavy bleeding, and infertility. It also can result in psychological and sexual problems. Many groups call FGM a gross violation of human rights of women and girls that has no health benefits for the victims. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 14 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Nigeria and its four neighbors have pledged a battalion each to a 7,500-strong force to fight the Nigerian terrorist group Boko Haram. And today is International Day of Zero Tolerance to Female Genital Mutilation. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The number of people who have died in the West Africa Ebola outbreak has topped 9,000. The World Health Organization says there have been more than 22,500 cases overall. The leaders of the UN effort to bring the Ebola epidemic under control say the three countries battling the virus need $1 billion now before the rainy season begins. WHO Assistant Director General Dr. Bruce Aylward says the international community has been very generous and understands what's at stake in the epidemic.
This crisis is different than so many of the crises that we're dealing with right now because you have to get to zero. That's reality. It started with one case. It will end with one case. We have to get to zero. And that requires a level of programmatic perfection that is so rare in terms of what we have to achieve in humanitarian and other relief efforts. You've got to be perfect to get to zero, which means it's got to be financed, you've got to have the right people in the ground, and you can't have gaps. If you have gaps, you have a flare, and then all of a sudden you have got large-scale Ebola again. The virus is telling us loud and clear what it's going to do. You know, the hard way to do this is what we're doing. The very, very hard way to do this is to try and do it when it's pouring rain, and that's what's going to happen in 2 months. There's still risk of new emergencies. So the big message today is the resources aren't there to avoid that risk.
The UN Secretary General's Special Envoy on Ebola, David Nabarro, disagrees with recently published research that claims disbursement of previous Ebola funds was slow and may have enabled the spread of the virus.
Actually, that wasn't what I've seen in my six visits in the region. And during the period October to December last year, more than $850 million were spent, more than 75% of the amount requested last year was pledged or committed by the end of the year. But it was difficult to implement the response in some places. We had to establish new ways of working because we haven't really had to respond to an outbreak of this size or complexity ever before.
The UN Secretary General Nabarro listed what's been done to fight the virus and save lives: 2,000 Ebola treatment beds, 255 teams to bury in safety and with dignity those who die of the virus, and 11,800 men and women who trace and monitor everyone who comes in contact with an infected individual. Nabarro called it a massive response. He expressed sensitivity to the social practice of washing and touching the deceased, but made a strong appeal for communities to suspend the practice during the health crisis.
The commonest way in which people are getting Ebola is through the rituals that take place when somebody is buried. To ask them to do so is asking a lot of them. However, unless it is a change, we're afraid that it's going to lead to quite widespread distribution of the virus.
Aylward said there was real improvement in following the spread of the virus from one person to another.
When all the cases come from contact lists, then we could almost say it's under control or it's manageable because we know where the transmission is.
Aylward reports that all newly discovered cases of Ebola in Liberia have come from people known to have been in contact with people previously infected. 54% of Guinea's new cases were also on health worker contact lists. 21% in Sierra Leone were on contact lists. In Guinea and Sierra Leone, those percentages have doubled each week in the past week.
The World Health Organization says many Ebola survivors are left with physical and psychological problems and will need help to recover from the debilitating after effects of the virus. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
Clinicians and other experts involved with the Ebola outbreak in West Africa have met at WHO headquarters to consider best care practices for current patients and to explore follow-up treatment for survivors. Many representatives came from Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, as well as from countries such as the Democratic Republic of Congo and Uganda that have had long experience with the disease. A key finding was that Ebola victims anywhere in the world have a better chance of survival if they receive very good care, including intravenous fluids and other symptomatic treatments. Fatality rates at good treatment centers in West Africa have dropped as low as 25%, the WHO group said, close to those in the United States and Europe, around 22%. The experts say seeking early treatment for Ebola, good hygiene, and better communal practices also contribute to better survival rates. They agree more attention must be paid to caring for pregnant women and children who are most vulnerable to the deadly illness. WHO technical advisor Margaret Harris says children under 5 have a very high rate of mortality, up to 90% for infants younger than 1 year.
This was often because they need a great deal of support to be fed, to be cared for, and there was quite some suggestion that simply being separated and isolated, as happens in an Ebola treatment unit, had a devastating psychological effect on children. They did not have parents, they did not have carers. There have been some approaches to encouraging survivors to take the role of carers with adequate infection prevention control measures.
Harris says the current standard of care for children is not working and must be changed. She says the experts are greatly concerned about the well-being of people convalescing from Ebola. Those survivors, Harris says, continue to have physical problems, especially muscle and joint pains, headaches and vision problems, and they experience psychological problems.
The psychological problems are more maybe due to post-traumatic stress disorder, but they may be due to a number of other things, and they range tremendously. So there's a huge need for ongoing care of people who've recovered from Ebola. There's a need to have such people on registries so that they can be followed up. And there's a particularly important need to follow up children who've been infected with Ebola and recovered, because we do not know whether this will have any effect on their neurological development and other development.
The experts say the so-called no-touch approach to treating Ebola victims has to go. Since healthcare workers must be in physical contact with Ebola patients to provide the best clinical care. However, that does not mean any change in protection for caregivers, who must continue to wear personal protective gear, including gloves, to resist infection by the virus. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. The International Monetary Fund has announced a $330 million financing package for the countries hardest hit by the Ebola epidemic. It includes $170 million in debt relief. The economies of Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone have suffered over the past year as the disease has spread. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Under the plan, $100 million in relief would come directly from the IMF, while $70 million would come in the form of debt forgiveness by IMF member nations. Jubilee USA Network Executive Director Eric LeCompte praises the move.
We're incredibly excited about it, and we had been working on this plan for quite some time. Initially, we brought the idea to the White House for $100 million in debt relief and to use an existing trust at the IMF to do that. They then brought it to the G20. The G20 then affirmed it and said we want at least a $300 million financing plan, and instructed the International Monetary Fund to create a financing plan that included debt relief, grants, and loans.
Jubilee is a faith-based anti-poverty organization.
Essentially, by international law, debt relief has to go into building infrastructure. So it'll be building hospitals, healthcare facilities, and schools in the three countries. This type of aid is aid that becomes immediately available, and the countries, instead of making debt payments, now put that money into building social infrastructure.
LeCompte would like to see an even broader relief for Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. The debt relief coming directly from the IMF is being done through the new Catastrophe Containment and Relief Window Trust.
What took place at the International Monetary Fund is they took a previous mechanism that was used to cancel the debt from Haiti in 2010, and they expanded that. And what this facility is able to do is when a very poor country, the poorest countries of the world, have an earthquake, a hurricane, any kind of major tragedy or health epidemic, they would qualify for either debt relief or innovative financing from grant-like monies provided from the International Monetary Fund.
LeCombe says the trust could greatly change how debt relief is given.
Right now, when any country is struggling or has a challenge, they need to go on their hands and knees to the International Monetary Fund or the Paris Club and beg for debt forgiveness. And it's a very challenging process. But what we have right now is much more responsible. It will only impact essentially the 20 poorest countries in the world when they have an economic shock like an epidemic or a hurricane. They have a place to go to for aid and relief.
The Paris Club, created in 1956, is a group of creditors that provides debt reduction or payment postponement to some countries. The Jubilee USA Network executive director spoke to VOA from the United Nations headquarters in New York. He addressed the General Assembly February 5th on debt, which he says is the main reason for global financial crises.
The General Assembly of the United Nations has voted to create a legally binding international bankruptcy process. And this week in New York is the first week of negotiations on creating that process. And I was asked to address all the delegates to talk about how this process can move forward, what's necessary for the process.
The IMF plan will not eliminate all the debt for Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. The countries are reported to have a combined debt stock of over $3 billion. That's blamed on past dictatorships, civil wars, and one-party rule. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 27 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Africa, I'm James Butter here to remind you that February is Black History Month here in the United States. And starting February 1st, we will begin our Black History Month series and daily quiz. Listen every morning as we profile historical African-American and African individuals and events. You can win a special Daybreak Africa calendar and other VOA goodies by answering one of our daily Black History questions. Please send your answers to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. You can also call us on 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. We will select a winner each morning from among the correct answers.
With your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll continue our collaboration with Channels TV as we examine the election process in Nigeria. Is the political playing field leveled? What's being done to ensure a peaceful, free, fair, and transparent vote? That's next time on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Nigeria and its four neighbors have pledged a battalion each to a 7,500-strong force to fight the Nigerian terrorist group Boko Haram. And the International Monetary Fund has announced a $330 million financing package for the country's hardest hit by the Ebola epidemic. Coming up, we'll have music from Burkina Faso. And in our feature segment, in Zimbabwe, government and health experts admit that the country's mental health sector has been long neglected. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. It's time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Happy Friday, Sunny.
Happy Friday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand that the Nations Cup culminates this weekend.
Kim, yes, indeed. Ghana will go against neighbor Ivory Coast in Sunday's 30th Africa Cup of Nations football final in Bata, Equatorial Guinea. Ghana advanced Thursday with a thorough 3-0 victory over host Equatorial Guinea in the capital, Malabo. Ghanaian football great Abedi Pele had reason to be proud. Two of his sons, Jordan and Andre, both scored for the Black Stars. But Equatorial Guinea did not have reason to be proud when it came to the shameful behavior of the local fans, who were responsible for a delay in the match of more than 30 minutes. Security forces fired tear gas and used a helicopter to clear the crowd, almost emptying the stadium before the game finally ended. Our African football guru David Legg tells us more.
The Equatorial Guinea fans absolutely frustrated at their rather meek surrender of their national team, losing 3-0 to Ghana. They took it out on the Ghanaian supporters and everybody else in general, hurling missiles right, left and center. And the sad thing, Sonny, is we've spoken so many times on your show about this. What particularly disappointed me was the very slow reaction of the security officials. Where exactly were they? The delay went on and on and on. And at one stage, I actually was worried if play would resume. In criticizing the spectators, I must praise the match officials. They clearly had a word with the two teams, and I noticed that instead of about 11 minutes of play when it did resume, they only played a couple of minutes and thankfully brought the game to a conclusion. But, you know, this is the second now big black stain, Sonny, on this Cup of Nations. Last Saturday, a very dubiously awarded penalty for Equatorial Guinea in a shock 2-1 win over Tunisia. And the latest on that, incidentally, is that Tunisia at this stage, just a few hours before the deadline to apologize to CAF, who were upset at the insinuation that they had basically fixed the result. The Tunisians are standing firm. They're not apologizing. And we could well face the situation that the 2017 qualifiers, where neither Morocco nor Tunisia, two of the giants of North African football, will be involved in the competition. And then moving on, Sonny, to the brighter side, so to speak, of the semi-final. Yes, a very proud father will be Abedi Pele. Jordan brought into the team for the injured Asamoah Gyan. He converted a penalty on 42 minutes to put Ghana ahead, and it was no more than the Black Stars deserved. They looked a class above the Equatorial Guineans from the very beginning. There is, after all, an 81-place difference between the countries on the FIFA world rankings. And the longer the game went on, the more obvious that became. And then to me, Sonny, the killer blow. 1 minute into stoppage time, a lightning counterattack by the Ghanaians caught the Equatorial Guineans cold. They were heavily outnumbered. It really was a question of which Ghanaian was going to shoot at goal. It was Mubarak Wakaso, and he rifled the ball past Felipe Ovono for the second goal. And I thought to myself, well, that's it. The Equatorial Guineans, they showed a lot of spirit. They resisted well, if at times a bit disorganized. But I couldn't see them getting two goals back. They just didn't have that firepower up front. Ghana came close on several occasions in the second half. And then with 15 minutes left came the inevitable third goal. Vono blocked the ball, but it ran loose to Kwesi Appiah, who crossed it for Andre Ayew to push the ball into the net. And that, Sonny, is the third goal by the senior of the two Ayews. He's the older brother of Jordan in this tournament. And a very comprehensive win. And it sets up what could be a really classic final. Ghana and Ivory Coast met in the final also in 1992. And that was goalless after 120 minutes. It went to a marathon penalty shootout, which the Ivorians won 11-10 for their only African Cup of Nations title. Ghana, on the other hand, they have won the title four times. But you've got to go back 33 years to Tripoli in Libya for their last triumph when they beat the Libyans on penalties after extra time. So the Ivorians, it's 23 years since their last title. Ghana, 33 years. So to put it mildly, Sonny, they're both very, very thirsty for another title.
David, getting back to the fan violence in Equatorial Guinea, do you expect any long-term suspension for Equatorial Guinea?
Well, it's a very interesting question, Sonny, because this Saturday, according to the schedule, at the same stadium in Malabo, Equatorial Guinea are due to play the Democratic Republic of Congo for third place in the tournament. Now, the question must be, can that match now go ahead in Malabo? I would suggest not. Perhaps it can be moved to the mainland, to Bata, with a very heightened security presence. And I really want to stress that, Sonny. I was deeply, deeply disappointed at the slow reaction of the security. They seemed to be almost paralyzed in the beginning. It was quite obvious what was going on, and yet they seemed to take forever to react. CAF, Sonny, they could get really tough. They could say, right, DR Congo get a walkover and they finish third. You know, there's a lot of debate, Sonny, about these third-place playoffs, whether there's any real value to them.
Finally, David, looking ahead to Sunday's final, do you anticipate a close match between the Elephants of Ivory Coast and the Black Stars of Ghana?
I do, Sonny. I don't see it as being one-sided, which unfortunately in the end both semifinals became. I mean, DR Congo put up a good fight against Ivory Coast, but when they went 3-1 down after 68 minutes, one had a sense of the Leopards. They had run their race and they weren't going to come back. But the Ivorians and the Ghanaians, Sonny, they look well matched. I mean, Sylvain Gbogo, the new Ivorian goalkeeper, I think he's brought a lot of solidity to the defence. And there you've got the likes of Kolo Touré, the great Liverpool defender. You've got Yaya Touré in midfield. And then up front, you've got Wilfred Bonney, eager to show that a £28 million transfer fee from Swansea to Manchester City was money well spent. So there's some stars on the Ivorian side. Of course, you've also got the dreadlock genius, Gervinho. And then if we turn to Ghana, they've got John Boy in defence. In midfield, you've got Andre Ayew pulling the strings. And the fact that they rested Asamoah Gyan, I think is going to turn out to be a good move because he probably now will fully recover from that abdominal injury he sustained in the quarterfinal win over Guinea, and he will be available for the final. So, Sonny, plenty of stars. I think a lot of anticipation. And dare I say it, let's just hope that a word that begins with S, S-E-C-U-R-I-T-Y, that spells security, is a very strong point. This just keeps repeating itself, Sonny. It's like a bad dream. And let's just hope that, dare I say it, CAF have learned a lesson.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg. Equatorial Guinea's head coach, Esteban Becker, apologized for the violent incidents in the semifinal against Ghana. Meanwhile, the Israeli head coach of Ghana, Avram Grant, praised the resilience of his players after the disturbances during the match.
Also in life, to know when things are not going well, to look for solution and not to give up. This is very important. And I saw it in my players from the first day, I must say. But as I told you before, I didn't know them so well, so I didn't know how to pick information, everything. And I must say they did it very, very well. They show a lot of mental strength in very difficult situation. And I think also they show to the people in the country that there is a group of players that they can count on them and enjoy from them.
That's Avram Grant, the head coach of Ghana's Nations Cup football team. Ghana will play neighbor Ivory Coast in Sunday's Nations Cup final in Bata, Equatorial Guinea. One of the Ghanaian reporters who witnessed Thursday's fan violence in Malabo is Samuel Tai Adano, who works for Ghana's Daily Graphic newspaper.
This is disgusting. A game of football, you either win, you draw, or you lose. So if you lose a game, must you be throwing bottles and stones? And I mean, it's unreasonable. And I think that the government or the CAF itself should take a look at this and either consider doing something to punish them, because it's not football. And at a point, some of the stones and the bottles were being thrown against them, and they felt unsafe. So the only thing was to move away. And because earlier on, there was information that if we beat them, they were going to beat us. Currently, we don't know even what is happening to our supporters. We hear two people are fear dead. That is information circulating. So it's quite dangerous. And even us as journalists from Ghana, we are not safe. We are afraid. And we are playing the final in Bata. We don't know our state now. So either the government looks at this or CAF takes the position in us.
That's Samuel Tai Adano, a reporter for Ghana's Daily Graphic newspaper. And Samuel spoke from Equatorial Guinea's capital, Malabo. In the wake of Thursday's crowd trouble, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, has fined Equatorial Guinea $100,000. CAF also says the country's national team, nicknamed the National Thunder, will have to play a game behind closed doors if there are any repeats of the crowd trouble. That means fans will attend Saturday's third-place match in Malabo between Equatorial Guinea and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Congolese defender Gabriel Zakuani tweeted that he wants the third-place match called off. Gabriel said, if the Equatorial Guinea fans are throwing rocks and glass at players, Equatorial Guinea can have third place, Zakuani said, and I quote, I love football, but I prefer to live. More than 30 fans were reportedly injured in the violence Thursday. In a statement, CAF said 14 fans were taken to hospital units, and one case requires close monitoring. On a happier note, five players are now tied for the Nations Cup Golden Boot Award, given to the top scorer at the end of the competition. All have three goals. They are Tieve Bifuma of Congo Brazzaville, Diamerci Mbokani of the Democratic Republic of Congo, Ahmed Akachi of Tunisia, Javier Balboa of Equatorial Guinea, and Andre Dede Ayew of Ghana. Ayew and Balboa each have one more match to play, so they can add to their total. But the other teams, the other players are on teams that have been eliminated. And let's hope for a very safe and secure Nations Cup final on Sunday. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahya Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And today, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 17:30 hours UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Coming up, the neglected mental health sector in Zimbabwe. And next, Zimbabwe still on analog broadcast. But first, some music. It is Ja Verite of Burkina Faso with Bekasso. Salut
on voulait merci, on vous dit merci. Oh oui, compauri, in que kinibara. Allahi tando, Allahi sutara. Vraiment bobo et beau. Bobo du lazo. Vraiment bobo et beau. Lahora. Bobo du lazo. Tu deviens tout nouveau. Ça va brûler ma bébé. Bibi, menya chamana mole charakila. Dunya mogalou. Personne te plaigne. Sans ni sera bobo. Iye, bobo kalou fonye. Moroya bébé. Ça va brûler ma bébé. La moroya bébé. Lahora, bobo du lazo, becaso, bebe, hangaso, mon adorato, bobo du lazo. Lahora, bobo du lazo, becaso, hangaso, mon adorato, bobo du lazo. Lahora, y'a la fraternité, la solidarité, de convivialité. Emmanuel Fogne, Radio Balafon Fogne, Yakuli Balice Fogne, Ye, Kusube Fogne, Marukanazwe Fogne, Chengini Baha Fogne, Stefano Sanu Fogne, Sanu Lassina Fogne, Halizata Kando Fogne, Ye, Kamoro Fogne, Kadhafi Fogne, Umarukanazwe Fogne, Afogne Kosobe.
Burkina Faso's Ja Verite with Bekaso.
In Zimbabwe, government and health experts recently admitted that the mental health sector has been long neglected. This despite enactment of the Mental Health Act in 1996, the Mental Health Policy in 2004, and the recently launched Strategic Plan for Mental Health Services designed to effectively implement all the regulations. Tenteta Gumbo reports.
Speaking in Harare at the launch of the Zimbabwe Strategic Plan for Mental Health Services, Health Minister Dr. David Parenyatwa said there are key issues that must be addressed to address mental health in Zimbabwe.
We need to implement that policy. So as a government, one of the things that we've done today is to launch that implementation policy from which then derives what activities we will do. One of them is to look at the human resources, which is what I just been asked about, how many there are. That's a big issue. The next issue is to look at prevention. What are we going to do to prevent more mental illness or mental disorders?
Indications are that Zimbabweans who suffer from mental health illnesses are not accessing health facilities or shy away due to the stigma associated with the health conditions. Dr. David Okello, World Health Organization country representative, said it is important to start looking at health in a holistic manner.
Health is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. To say somebody is healthy, a country is moving towards a healthy direction, you need to look at all that.
Dr. Okello echoed Dr. Parenyatua's sentiments and also appealed to the government to effectively implement its mental health strategy.
It is our hope that the launch we are going to initiate today, Zimbabwe Strategic Plan for Mental Health Services, will bring mental health services, mental health program at the forefront and raise the profile of these services at high level, at the next level.
Winnie Ndoro, a sonographer in a private radiology department and a person who's living with bipolar disorder, said the key to living with a mental health condition is to learn and understand how it affects a person on a daily basis.
Because you're bipolar, you've got ups and downs. When you get something which excites you, you get too excited. Even though you'll be on medication, but you have this it's called a roller coaster of emotions. You're up and you're down, you're up and you're down. But it's been a hard road. It's been difficult.
Doro said she decided to speak about her condition in order to tackle the stigma associated with her condition. She hopes this will do the same for people with the same or other mental health disorders.
I didn't hide myself. I didn't put a shell around myself. I was open. I would go talk about it at church, talk about it at work, talk about it everywhere I would. I would just talk about it.
The Ministry of Health, along with other national and international partners, is expected to begin implementing a strategic plan that is expected to effectively address many issues in the mental health sector. Experts say with this plan, cases of mental health can be effectively treated and regulated. This is Tatenda Gumbo.
And the Zimbabwe Broadcasting Corporation and the Zimbabwe Revenue Authority are reportedly working with police at roadside checkpoints to demand radio licenses. This in an effort to increase revenues and finance a move from analog to digital broadcasting. Zimbabwe is the only country broadcasting on analog. Former radio personality Ezra Shisa Sibanda tells reporter Chris Gandhi in Bulawayo the delay in switching over has shortchanged Zimbabweans.
At the moment, to be honest with you, there's nothing, there are no signs at all. Zimbabwe, as you know, that is part of the African countries which agreed to go digital last year, and Zimbabwe violated that agreement because they didn't go digital. Then they said by the time the world, the last day when the world says all the countries of the world should go digital, Zimbabwe said by May of 2015, we will have a digitalization of all our broadcasting or everything here. But at the moment, it's dead quiet. There are no signs. You can't see anything. We have these so-called independent radio stations. Obviously, those two, they've gone digital. But as for Zimbabwe Broadcasting Corporation, there's nothing yet. There are no signs at all.
Some of the benefits of digitalization are the good quality and also the expansion of TV and radio stations. Now, can you tell us from your point of view, when you watch or listen to ZBC, what can you say about the quality right now?
At the moment, what is happening to people who are paying for radio licenses and TV licenses is insulting, and I believe that that's criminal. If you go around texting cars, stopping cars, demanding radio licenses, TV licenses at homes, and knocking at people's doors, making roadblocks, what is your offering that pathetic poor service is actually insulting to the ordinary people of Zimbabwe who are suffering to pay for those licenses. At the moment, you can't sit down and listen to radios. You can't sit down and watch television. The people now are sacrificing, really buying all this satellite television to watch TV, relying on the so-called pirate radio station to give them proper information. I believe that even despite those radio stations which are based outside broadcasting Zimbabwe, they get better quality than something which is broadcast here local. It sounds like a tin. It's empty, it's tiny, it's thin. There's nothing showing that we are really moving. We are really moving in a modern world. We are actually going backwards, because the quality before, during our time, was far much better than now.
That was former radio personality Ezra Shisa Sibanda speaking with reporter Chris Gandhi from Bulawayo. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Peter Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The nature of the terrorist threat has evolved over the course of the past several years. While the threat posed by al-Qaeda with its centralized hierarchical terrorist command structure has now diminished, largely as a result of leadership losses suffered by the AQ Corps, other violent extremist groups have emerged. Groups that have become active in places like Yemen, Syria, Libya, Iraq, and Somalia are mainly localized, but some pose a threat to Western interests in Europe and the United States, and we take these security concerns very seriously. Lately, the most visible manifestation of terrorism in the West has come in the context of so-called lone wolf offender attacks, as we saw in the case of the terrorist assassinations at the Paris publication Charlie Hebdo. Only by working together can the international community successfully counter groups like these, said Tina Cadenow, U.S. Ambassador-at-Large and Coordinator for Counterterrorism. Take ISIL, for example. We have worked to build an effective anti-ISIL coalition, a coalition that is clearly crucial because the fight against ISIL is not one the U.S. can or should pursue alone. More than 60 partners are contributing to this effort, which is multifaceted in its goals, not only to stop ISIL's advance on the ground, but to combat the flow of foreign fighters, disrupt ISIL's financial resources, and counteract ISIL's messaging and undermine its appeal, said Ambassador Cadenow. The United States believes a successful approach to counterterrorism must revolve around partnerships. Effective partnering means identifying governmental, non-governmental, and multilateral actors overseas that can make a difference in this battle against the most salient terrorist threats facing the international community. Partners come with various capabilities and varying amounts of political will. So cultivating them is not just a matter of diplomatic engagement, but also means working with them to develop the technical and practical skills needed to counter terrorism within their borders and beyond. The threats we confront are serious and far-reaching, and it will take considerable time and effort to develop the partnerships and institutional components we need to address them, said Ambassador Cadenow. Nevertheless, we believe this is the most effective and sustainable approach to a complex and enduring challenge.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Your ears on Music Time in Africa.
your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This one, this one,
every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here